This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500. My name is Alan Scott. Now, I know you're curious about BGov. Feel free to hit us up on the web, bgov.com. When you do, you'll see that BGov is the only information service provider. I repeat, only information service provider in Washington that focuses on the business impact of government actions. We've partnered ourselves with our good friends at Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, to kind of bring that concept to the airwaves each and every Thursday at 11 and Fridays at 2:30. Want to find out more? Like I said, bgov.com. That's bgov.com. This week, we're turning our sights on the world of energy, and I've got some experts here in studio to help me decode what's happening on the Hill and elsewhere. Congress may not be in session, but we don't take any time off. Lauren Duggan, Derek Wallbank, Bloomberg Government's congressional and legislative analysts are going to be here a little later to help us understand the fight on the Hill as it relates to all things like, you know, irreplaceable fossil fuel versus renewable energy, and what's that Keystone Pipeline anyway, and why does it play into these arguments? We'll also have Rich Heidhorn Jr., an analyst at BGov who authored a study entitled Nuclear Revival Sputters as U.S. Incentives Prove Inadequate. Barack Obama said that he wants the country to generate 80% of its electricity from clean energy sources by 2035. Is that possible? Are there hurdles? What about the Three Mile Island disaster? We haven't built anything since in 30 years, nuclear power related. Rich is going to help us understand what's going on in that space. But my first guest is one who knows all about election year politics, especially with regard to energy being an extremely hot topic this time of year. Lots of frustration about the price of gasoline lately, but rarely do you hear any complaints about the electric power sector. In a brand new study entitled Twilight of Coal-Fired Power, energy analyst Rob Barnett is here to discuss a new big proposal from the EPA and how it could reshape how we generate electricity here in the U.S. Hey, Rob, how are you?
Great. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining us. So you've put together this big study. I've got it right here in my hot little hand, fresh off the web. What have you found?
Well, the Environmental Protection Agency has a multitude of regulations, and they're generally putting out new rulemakings all the time. Their most recent proposal would effectively ban or block the construction of new coal-fired power plants going forward. This is a unprecedented move from the agency, and it really does spell a sea change for the power sector.
New power plants would be required to emit less than 1,000 pounds of carbon dioxide per megawatt hour. How difficult will that be to achieve?
Well, I can understand that most people probably don't think in terms of pounds per megawatt hour. So, well, let me help you frame that number. A coal plant emits nearly twice that amount.
Okay.
And so it, frankly, just can't meet the standard. So the standard blocks coal.
Which now, makes sense why the regulation is now preventing any retired plant from being rebuilt.
That's right.
Okay.
Natural gas plants can meet the standard without any trouble, though. They emit about 800 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour, so they can easily comply. And keep in mind, though, all of this is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Natural gas emits about half the amount of carbon dioxide compared with a coal-fired power plant.
I'm glad you brought up greenhouse gases, because it's an election year, as we know. How will greenhouse gases play as the fight wages on?
Well, I don't see it as being that important of an issue.
I think it tipped the scale one side or the other.
That's right. I mean, generally folks across the country care about the environment when the economy is going well. I think other issues are really top of mind. I think all things being equal, there's certainly always concern about the environment, but climate change is a very complex issue. I don't think the president's going to make any aggressive new proposals, and I think Mitt Romney is probably trying to tread very lightly on the topic. In his home state of Massachusetts, he actually implemented a cap and trade program for carbon dioxide emissions while he was governor. So I think and that's something that's probably not too popular with his own party. I think both candidates, for a variety of reasons, are going to want to focus on other topics, probably things related to the economy as opposed to climate.
Right. So banning the construction of new coal-fired power plants isn't really a departure from business as usual. It's kind of like banning, I don't know, something random, like cars that can fly maybe? Or
sure. You're stealing a line from the study, actually.
Maybe it's written here, and it's a wonderful study. By the way, I'm talking to Rob Barnett, who is the author of The Twilight of Coal-Fired Power, the EPA's New Standards for Greenhouse Gases. Did steal a line from the study. You are correct.
You're absolutely right, though. I mean, no serious companies right now are considering building new coal-fired power plants in the United States. So in some ways, it is akin to banning cars that fly. No companies are out there really with serious proposals to build cars that fly. No companies are out with serious proposals to build new coal-fired power plants. And the reason why is because natural gas is so cheap right now. Right. The economics are very compelling, and gas is the default fuel of choice in the power sector right now. It's what any new power plant is considering if a company's building a new plant right now.
Shifting gears slightly, let's talk a little bit about what's on everybody's minds these days. I mean, we've got lots of cars driving up and on the highways and byways, and you got to pull into a gas station at some point. Little sticker shock. I mean, I'm constantly pulling out the calculator going, I just paid how much for how many miles per gallon, and I need to stop driving, or this, that, and the other. Where are those prices? Are things going to level off?
Well, great question, and I think it's very telling. We have two separate markets here in the United States. Natural gas is very cheap right now, relatively speaking. Mm-hmm. Gasoline, on the other hand, is near record highs. The national average retail price for gasoline right now is $3.89 per gallon. That's a little bit lower than it was about a month ago, so we have seen some relief, but really gasoline prices are a function of global oil prices. There's a lot of geopolitical tensions that go into that. Mm-hmm. There are global supply-demand balance issues that really affect that price. I mean, China is growing very rapidly. They want to consume a lot of energy as part of that growth. And really, demand from China has put a lot of upward pressure on gasoline prices, and we're just feeling that here in the United States right now.
You took part in a four-part study that Bloomberg released a little while back. Fuel economy standards, impact on the U.S. automobile fleet, impact on gasoline demand, impact on greenhouse gas emissions. Let's talk a little bit about CAFE, because the government is trying to step in and assist, but is it going to work?
Well,
let's define CAFE. How about that?
Yeah, it's not a coffee at your local coffee shop. CAFE stands for Corporate Average Fuel Economy Standards, and it's basically the government's measure for efficiency from automobiles. And there are a lot of questions on the campaign trail about what the president can do about the price of gasoline. And frankly, there's not much that any president or any political figure could do about prices in the short run. I mean, frankly, the market's, the price is set by the market. Over the long term, though, the president and others can do things to try and insulate consumers and the nation from, volatility in prices. And so what the president has done with the corporate average fuel economy standards is trying to, over time, kind of bend back the demand curve. Mm-hmm. And so what the requirements are is that over time, new automobiles have to improve the efficiency. So by 2025, the current proposed regulations would say all new automobiles sold in 2025 have to get 55.5 miles per gallon. So that's almost like everyone driving the equivalent of a Prius
sure.
in 2025.
Well, we'll see if it works. If it does come out to fruition, that all stars align and our CAFE does come, well, it is brewed nicely. How about that? Since it's not really coffee, I'll just.
Sure.
All right, that was silly.
But it is going to have it is going to have important implications for consumers because no one knows where gasoline prices are going to go in the future. I mean, there are a lot of people who spend time thinking about it, but no one knows for sure. But if everyone drives cars that use less fuel, really the question is almost sort of moot because if you don't use as much gasoline, you're a little less concerned about where the price is headed. And our analysis indicates that it will push down U.S. gasoline and oil demand over time. But it's going to take years because people don't drop everything and buy new cars every month or something like that.
Right. His name is Rob Barnett, written several studies on Bloomberg government, the latest of which, Twilight of Coal-Fired Power. Rob, will you stick around with me? Because I'd like to bring in Rich Hydorn Jr. Rich is a man who knows an awful lot about energy as well, yet another energy analyst who's written an in-depth study entitled Nuclear Revival Sputters as U.S. Incentives Prove Inadequate. Rich, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So a little while ago, Rob just mentioned that that natural gas is king. Yet the president has said that he wants clean energy to be the one to take over 80% of the electrical needs for the country. $8.3 billion kind of paving the way for those nuclear plants in the first 30 years. Do we have any under construction? Where are we? What's happening in this space right now?
Yes, well, natural gas actually qualifies as clean under President Obama's definition.
Good distinction. Thank you.
There is concern about putting too many eggs in the natural gas basket because it has historically been a very volatile fuel in terms of price. So back in 2005, Congress approved some incentives to try and jumpstart a new generation of nuclear power plants. As you mentioned, since Three Mile Island, the nation had not commissioned for about three decades a new power plant, although half of our current fleet actually opened after Three Mile Island.
About 52 or so.
Yes.
Probably about 104 out there
so
now.
So right now we get 20% of our electricity from nuclear power, but if no new plants are built and the current licenses are allowed to expire and not extended beyond the 60 years that they're currently limited to, we're going to lose about a third of our nuclear capacity by 2035.
One of the things that they did improve moving forward as they're offering these incentives was making it a little easier for operating licenses and constructional licenses as well. Kind of a one-stop shop these days rather than having to go to multiple places. What other incentives are out there at this point?
The other incentives we looked at specifically were financial incentives, a production tax credit, and loan guarantees. And we wanted to see how much are they helping. And certainly they are having an impact. You asked about how many plants are being built right now. Southern Company and Scana Corporation are building four reactors in Georgia and South Carolina, respectively. They are the only ones being built and are likely to be the only ones in the foreseeable future because in the last few years, the price of natural gas has just fallen off the cliff, and nuclear power can't compete even with these financial incentives, is what our study found.
We're speaking with Rich Heidorn Jr., who's written a study called Nuclear Revival Sputters as U.S. Incentives Prove Inadequate. It's BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio. Rob Burnett's still here with us. Rob, you had a question.
You bet. So you talked about how that natural gas prices were really putting pressure on nuclear power, and even with the incentives, the new nuclear power plants wouldn't be competitive with natural gas. So what would the incentives need to be in order to put nuclear in the money?
Well, what we found was that you'd have to increase the production tax credit about fivefold to make nuclear power competitive at current prices. If we saw natural gas return to $6 per MMBTU, which is where it was a few years ago, then you'd only need to eliminate the current cap on the production tax credit. We also looked at the loan guarantees, and what we found is that's a subject that we've heard a lot about in the context of Solyndra. These are somewhat different programs, but a lot of the foundation is similar. And there's been an ongoing dispute between DOE and OMB over how much we should be charging these companies for these essentially premiums on these loan guarantees. And as a result, about $10 billion is probably likely to go unclaimed.
To jump in on that point, Rich, you know, really for folks thinking about nuclear power and what a carbon tax might mean, or carbon fee, cap and trade, whatever you want to call it, I think the best advice, though, is that it's going to be years before we see any kind of comprehensive climate legislation in the United States that might bring about something like that. So if you're hoping for that to help nuclear power, you're going to be waiting for a long time.
I would agree, and the only thing that's going to help nuclear power is if some of those in Congress who say they support nuclear power but oppose carbon legislation drop the latter position.
So the limitations that we were just discussing with regard to the incentives that are now proving to be inadequate, as the study states, we had a handful of people apply for several dozen, I would imagine, applied for the possibility of opening a nuclear reactor. Most of them have backed out now.
Correct. Correct. And that's because they've seen natural gas prices fall, and a few years ago it looked like we might have carbon legislation. When both of those changes came to pass, very few companies are even considering nuclear power anymore. Exelon would love to build nuclear power. They're the biggest operator in the country, but they won't touch it under the current market.
Well, you know, Rich, maybe just to conclude this thought, I think there are a lot of folks in the nuclear business who talk about the idea of a nuclear renaissance. My sense from hearing you talk today is that doesn't sound too likely. How would you characterize the overall state of the business if you look out to, say, 2030, 2035, those long-term ambitions that Alan mentioned when he was kicking off the segment here?
Well, going out that far, lots can change. And I think if concerns over global warming increase and become more politically mainstream, and you have fewer Republicans who are dismissing that as an issue that we shouldn't be concerned about, then it may improve the posture of nuclear power. I think nuclear power ultimately is going to have a future in this country, but I wouldn't bet it on it short term.
Very good. Gentlemen, thank you very much. We've been speaking with Rich Heidern Jr., author of the study Nuclear Revival Sputters as U.S. Incentives Prove Inadequate, and Rob Barnett. Rob, thanks for coming as well. Twilight of Coal-Fired Power, the EPA's New Standards on Greenhouse Gases. It's BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio. I'm Ellen Scott. And in studio with me now, a couple of guys very familiar with the inner workings of Congress. Even though they're on a break right now, these guys are working hard to bring you the dirt. The dirt that they find on the Hill. And here with all of that dirt, I've got a couple of guys, Lauren Duggan, Derek Wallbank, congressional and legislative analysts, respectively. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Alan.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. So we're just going to run through rapid fire some stuff, all right? Because they're on recess right now, but they're going to come back to a world of stuff to deal with. Keystone Pipeline. Why don't we bring everybody up to speed? Number one, what is it, and why is it important? Where's the fight? What's going on?
Sure. Well, the Keystone Pipeline is a pipeline that a Canadian company wants to build from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, all the way through Oklahoma and down to the bottom of Texas. And it's run into a little bit of a hitch. And the hitch is that that sort of thing requires a presidential-level permit to cross the border. And they've been trying to get that. The administration was put into a corner through a previous bill, and they said, you have to approve this within a certain amount of time. The administration said, you will not force our hands. No. It's not that the Obama administration is necessarily anti the entire pipeline, but they're anti those time limits, and they've resisted hard on that. Now, where this comes in now is that the Keystone Pipeline is a part of the House Republicans' transportation proposal. Uh-huh. And they've said, look, if you want your surface transportation funding, what you're going to have to do is not you have a deadline, you have to approve the pipeline. And that's where we got a sticking point on that right now.
All right. Federal transportation programs we're talking about, as you just brought that up. A bill driven by election year politics. We've kind of reached the home stretch with regard to the highway bill.
Well, that's certainly what the people in the House and the Senate hope. But this bill has been a struggle for several years now. They've finally gotten to the stage where a group of House members and Senate members are going to get in a room and try and hammer out an agreement for some length of time. Transportation bills tend to be 5 or 6 year bills, and instead they've been operating on extensions of anywhere from a month to 3 months to 6 months. And state transportation departments don't like that. They want to be able to plan these projects for long periods of time, and mm-hmm. 2 or 3 months doesn't really give you that. So they have a June 30th deadline right now to come up with some sort of agreement to move beyond that June 30th date. This Keystone thing is a complication.
I was just about to ask you, is this one of the energy-related things that's within this bill?
That's the big energy-related thing.
Okay.
House Republicans had desires to put a lot of different energy things in there, but they were stymied in getting the centerpiece of it, the actual highway, transit, and safety portion, through the House. And so they went to conference, which is this negotiating mechanism, with a bill that doesn't really say that much about transportation. It's basically a 3-month extension of current policy, whereas the Senate's coming in with a 2-year bill that makes changes to the different programs, adjusts some funding levels here and there, and is a more comprehensive approach. Somehow, with those two unequal positions, they're going to try and hammer out an agreement. And
gloves are going to come off. It's going to get ugly.
Right. Although much of this won't happen in the public eye, theoretically. Right. They can have 1 or 2 public meetings and then do all the big work behind closed doors.
Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about coal ash provisions. I found an article here produced a couple of days ago from the Charleston Daily Record. It's referencing Rep. David McKinley talking to Jay Rockefeller, Senator Jay Rockefeller, and he says, and I quote, he just doesn't get it. referring to the importance of preventing federal regulators from labeling coal ash as hazardous waste. He just doesn't get it. Is that good? Bad? What's going on?
Well, coal ash is a sort of a complicated thing that the campaigns that you'll hear about coal ash almost have little or nothing to do with what the coal ash situation actually is. What happened is that in 2008, there was a big spill of coal ash. It's sort of like a recycled product that's kept wet and sort of dammed up and stored that way. And there was a big spill. And we're talking about this coal ash slurry that covered 3,000 feet, or that could have covered 3,000 acre feet of land about a foot deep. And that's the sort of volume that we're talking about. And EPA said, well, you know, we've got to have something to regulate that. And what they're trying to figure is, do we need to regulate this as hazardous or not hazardous? And there's a provision as I say, Republicans are trying to get through that would say that it's not hazardous and that would be a lot cheaper for some of these companies that already store coal ash to keep it stored. So that's really what we're talking about here. And so you're looking at about a dozen or so companies that really would feel the brunt of that. And this is another one of those things that Republicans have said, well, we don't want these burdensome regulations killing jobs. And so you're going to see the campaign really sort of play out in the jobs phase. You've seen it before. This is another subject.
Right. This coal ash, by the way, we'll point out, is also used in concrete. Putting the stuff is an integral ingredient in concrete. So dubbing it as hazardous would be detrimental to the concrete production in the U.S.
You would think so. And actually, that's what some of the campaign will go at. But the EPA, when they've been talking, and this isn't a final thing yet, but when they've been talking, they've been saying, well, we're going to have an exemption for the stuff that's recycled into this.
Ah.
Don't expect to hear that in the campaign, though. There, in fact, there was a bill that has already passed the House once that would deal with it, and so what Republicans have done is they've sort of tucked that and they've said, well, we're gonna try and get this through not as a standalone bill, but sort of tucked in.
We're running out of time here, real quick. We're talking to Lauren Duggan and Derek Wallbank, a couple of congressional and legislative analysts from BGov. Real quick, appropriations. Where are we with that fight at this point?
Well, the House Appropriations Committee has reported out 2 bills, and the Senate Appropriation Committee 4. What we think may happen next week is one of those bills, maybe the one covering commerce, justice, and science programs being NASA, the National Science Foundation, will come to the House floor and the process will really kick off. There's no telling how that's going to go yet. You know, it could be an open, freewheeling amendment process, which is fun if you like to watch legislating, but could be some late nights in store once they really get to the appropriations bills. But this is just the beginning of the process.
And
it's a long way to go.
I'm sure you two will both be back to keep us up to date.
Hopefully.
Lauren Duggan. Derek Wallbank, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. But just about does it for Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact right here on Federal News Radio. A reminder, you can learn more about Bloomberg Government's award-winning analysis, tools, and data at www.bgov.com. That's BGOV.com. You can also follow us at Twitter. We're on the Twitter, you know. That's @BloombergGov. Thanks to Rob Barnett, who studied the twilight of coal-fired power. The EPA's new standards for greenhouse gases is now available, as is Rich Heidorns Jr.'s piece on nuclear revival sputters as U.S. incentives prove inadequate. That's all on www.bgov.com. Let's regroup next Thursday, shall we? Say around 11 a.m. Got lots to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500, I'm Alan Scott.